Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and I'm joined today by Lab 111's programmer, Tom Ohm.
Hello there.
And our producer, Elliot Bloom.
Hello, hello.
Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us be found by other film fans. And make sure to get tickets to our next Film Club edition. Make sure to get tickets to our next Film Club edition, which will be a screening of the cult classic Juice on the 30th of January, starring Tupac Shakur. We're bringing this film back to the big screen to coincide with a conversation we had with the iconic director Ernest Dickerson, who you might know from his work with Spike Lee as a cinematographer. Link for tickets are in the show notes. This year, vampires once again crawl out of the darkness and back into the spotlight with the release of Robert Eggers' remake of Nosferatu. In honor of this vampire renaissance, Lab 111 introduces its program Lust for Blood, highlighting the immortal cinema of bloodsuckers and night stalkers. Today, we'll dive into the history of vampires in cinema, but first, Tom, what have you been watching recently?
I forgot to see a film that I then saw and was really happy that I saw it.
And can we...
Anora.
Oh, finally. Welcome.
Yeah, which was really weird because I missed it when it came out. And then, you know that sometimes even if you watch a lot of movies, then sometimes you just forget that you need to see a film. And the discourse around it felt like I wasn't really sure I was going to like it. And I fucking loved it.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Oh, me too. I also saw it without knowing anything about it because I saw it at like an advanced screening and I did hear a little bit of buzz, but I had no idea what it was going to be about. And I was like, oh, this is what this is?
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, because like my colleagues who saw it in Cannes were like, yeah, it's just a movie about screaming kids. And I was like, oh, it's just going to be a super hysterical, more like Tangerine Sean Baker. And then the ending of Anora just completely blew me away. I was like, wait, but my colleagues didn't get it. The entire thing about the film is, yes, everybody is constantly screaming, so the denouement of the ending is like, shh. And that hits way harder than it would if the movie is more balanced. It is very much in your face. So yeah, I was really I was happy I catched up on something that was way better than I had expected.
Yeah, it's so lovely. Yesterday morning I saw A Real Pain, which I also like, I'm going to immediately overshare and say was the first day of my period. So I was crying in a big way.
Like, I get that.
I sat down and I see Kieran Culkin's face and he does something to me where I just like care about him so much. I don't, maybe because like evolutionarily, like I grew up with him.
Yeah.
I saw him when like we're
his brother.
A little bit the same age, like 5 years older, I think. But it's like, oh yeah, I care about him so much. And like the movie started and I almost immediately just like started bawling. And then and they're just both so good. We also really need to give Jesse Eisenberg his flowers for that, because the whole thing in the movie is that everybody pays attention to Kieran Culkin's character and everybody kind of forgets about Jesse Eisenberg's character in the movie. And I feel like this is also happening in all the discourse surrounding the movie, where everyone's like, man, Kieran Culkin's going to get that Oscar. And it's like Jesse Eisenberg's just standing in the corner like, I made this.
And who would have thought that, at least for me, seeing Jesse Eisenberg as this, like he's always the OCD stuck up dude in any movie. But if he directs himself, apparently then it really works. Like, oh, I care for you.
I also love, I think the top Letterboxd review was like, I can't believe Jesse Eisenberg wrote into a movie that he has beautiful feet.
Yeah.
It's like, he wrote that.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah. No, but it's a very touching film. And it's weird to say that one of the best things about the film is that it's just 90 minutes and it does everything that you wanted to do.
Welcome back, 90 minute movies.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love nothing more than a 90 minute movie. But today we're going to be talking about something very different than the two films we just talked about. We're going to dive into the history of vampires in cinema. I don't know why I start so many of my introductory monologues saying that I was a horny teenager, but to elaborate on what I've stated before, I was a horny goth teenager. There were black clothes and black hair and leather spike chokers. A love for vampires, and much like Ellen and Nosferatu, I didn't really know the source of my obsession. And now I do. I was 14 and I felt like an outcast, and Spike from Buffy was really hot. Sometimes it's just not that deep. As I mentioned in the intro, The Immortal Vampire is back in cinema this year, and I started wondering, how do we get here? How do we move from that, like, bat-like, crazy creature to, like, Robert Pattinson with six-pack abs? In film, we often refer back to Dracula, the book written in 1897 by Irish author Bram Stoker, but the idea of blood-drinking nightwalkers goes back way further. One of the earliest known vampire legends comes from ancient Mesopotamia, and even with being blood-sucking pests, women did it first and get very little credit for it. The Lilith was said to be a demon-like entity who loved sucking the blood of men, which, like, don't tempt me with a good time, am I right? But since the invention of cinema, Dracula has been the gold standard. Famously, Murnau's silent film Nosferatu pulled one of those "can I copy your homework, I won't make it obvious" things in 1922, which got him sued by Stoker's estate for copyright infringement, and all copies of the film were destroyed, but obviously not because we're watching it now. That iteration of vampire mostly represented sexual repression, an unholy power against the Catholic Church, and fear of immigration, with some saying that Max Schreck's Nosferatu quite closely resembles some of the pretty bleak anti-Semitic stereotypes of the time, with, like, the big hooked nose, the thick brows, the hunched back, and, you know, immigrating from the East bringing plague and destruction. But vampires, both as a myth and a figure in cinema, have evolved to reflect whatever society fears at the time, as well as its desires. Over time, vampires have come to represent so much more. Desire, immortality, loneliness, and each era's vampire tells us something about the culture it came from. The fears of disease, from the Black Plague to the AIDS epidemic, the sexual liberation of the 60s, and yearning for eternal love in the 2000s. While we mostly think of vampires as bloodthirsty monsters, in recent decades, the idea of the good vampire has become quite popular. With Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, but also characters like Angel from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Edward Cullen from Twilight, they show hot vampires struggling with the whole "you can't have your cake and eat it too" nature, where they're all like, "I want to suck your blood, but also I love you." Where they're self-aware kings capable of love, remorse, and self-control, making them more than the bloodthirsty symbol of pure evil and more like tragic heroes. At the end of the day, the vampire is, pun intended, a reflection of our darkest longings and our most painful realities. Whether it's a grotesque, blood-drinking, heavy breather, or a sparkling himbo, the vampire continues to capture something about what it means to be human. And maybe that's why we keep coming back to them, because in the end, the vampire story is just a story about us. So Tom, I really love that we're doing a huge program about vampires. As you can tell, I'm quite passionate about this. But what is the reason that we're doing this program at Lab right now?
Well, kind of grew from an idea that we did a couple of programs with Van der Velle, who are an artist collective. We did some things around an album they were releasing, and these were very nice sort of genre film selections. So at some point, after we did a more, a feminist program around The Witch as a feminist icon, they said, shouldn't we sort of reevaluate what the vampire as a cultural and pop cultural icon really is? And then I started thinking about it and was like, what are the sort of themes underlying of these? Well, you touched upon most of them, underlying this character or this icon
phenomenon.
Yeah. That's a thing. That's a word. That's a nice word.
okay, cool.
Talk to me, Laura. And while we were together making that selection, it was very interesting to see that, well, of course you have the Dracula story, the Nosferatu story, depends on who stole from what, really, to say if it's the Nosferatu or the Dracula story. And they're all pretty much the same story, right? We've seen that story millions of times. But I think some of the themes in that, the longing, the lust, the yearning, the sort of being taken over by this entity that longs for you, and that, yeah, that returns in every vampire story, really. And me, much like you, I was brought up with Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I could include in the cinema a series, we would also be screening Buffy the Vampire. Yeah, I mean, that was so highly impactful in my youth that I was always very much intrigued by the vampire. And then when I got older, I kind of lost. I mean, Twilight wasn't made for me.
No, I thought it was. Thought they like consulted with you on that.
Yeah, yeah, with the 12-year-old girl in me was consulted to talk about how Edward Cullen was needed to be portrayed.
Okay, so the program is called Lust for Blood, and that is basically saying that the whole vampire figure is a representation of
lust, sensuality. There's there's this weird sexual nature in the act of blood sucking, I would say, but also this you know, the terminology of a surrounding this figure, like creatures of the night, this sort of night elite, what you see in movies like Only Lovers Left Alive, where it's this battle between, oh great, I'm immortal, but I need to kill other people to stay like that, and then what the fuck do I do with my time? Yeah. But
like,
which
even
is also
now, I'm like barely employed, and I already feel like, wow, this must be what it's like to be a vampire, to just like hang out. I guess I'll go to that dark room in Lab 111 where I can like watch another movie.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. If a vampire would really be amongst us, would they be so fucking bored that they would be watching films about vampires? Like, oh my God, yeah.
Honestly, to kind of like launch forward, we're going to be talking about a ton of different movies that we're screening here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. But there's one that I recently rewatched, was Interview with the Vampire, that does that beautiful thing when he like grows old through the ages. And then at some point, that like made me cry when he's like, and then at some point I got to see a sunset again, and he's like in the movies seeing a motherfucking sunset. Are you kidding me? What? That was so beautiful. It's like an homage to cinema. It's like, oh yeah, vampires must have been so fucking stoked when movies came around. They could just like see daylight again, but not, I don't know what the rules are,
but
on that.
But not have it fucking kill him.
Yeah, but that was beautiful. But yeah, obviously another reason that the timing for the program is Eggers as Nosferatu.
This creature is a force more powerful than evil. Its desire is to consume all life on Earth. Only you can redeem us.
It's coming.
The thing is, I thought it was pretty good, and I think it's better if you're looking for this. It's not The Lighthouse, but nothing really is The Lighthouse. It's Eggers doing a story that's been told a lot of times, but telling that really good and very visually arresting.
And what I also thought is, like, it's very suspenseful in a way that makes sense for our generation, because like I spent the last 2 weeks watching, I think, almost every single iteration of this story. Mm-hmm. And this one does the really cool suspense with, like, there's a couple of jump scares in there, but they're not tacky. And it's constantly like moving forward in a way that works for my brain.
But it still very much is classic gothic horror.
Yes.
Which I thought was, and this makes no sense, refreshing. Because it is still a bit of a dusty movie, but it does it in such a way that it, you know, it's this weird balance between, it's almost like this, it is an A24 movie, but the costumes are different, and the jump scares are completely of an ilk that's more what we used to do in the 90s.
Yeah.
But then it's also, jump scares are, I mean, you've probably watched Smile. I haven't.
Okay,
thank God.
We can still make podcasts. That's the only genre that I can't.
But The Conjuring, shit like that. Like, there's this shot of the actor whose name I always forget, with Patrick. Patrick Wills, isn't that?
That's, I don't know.
That's the singer of the Beach Boys. No.
No, that's Brian Wilson.
Or is it Brian?
Come on,
anyway,
dude,
Patrick
get
something.
Your facts straight.
Like, there's a shot of him. And reverse shot, reverse back shot. Oh, and there's this thing behind him. Ah! And Eggers does this, but then with very slow pans towards a room where there's nothing and somebody holding like a lamp. Like, oh, there's something gonna be there's, and then the pan just camera pans back and like, oh, there's something gonna be behind her. Oh, there's not. Oh, it's right there. So yeah, because he does do that.
Because he established the rules like right before the title card, it goes boo, jump scare. And you're like, oh, okay, so the rules of this movie is there could just be a jump scare at any time. Which makes the entire thing really tense, as you say, that like the camera moves really slow. He's like, oh, bitch, there's going to be a thing, isn't there? But there, most of the time there isn't, but the tension has already been established by putting a jump scare.
Yeah, but we've become so used to the fact that that's just pure cheese, right? Mm-hmm. Jump scares have become this, like, I don't nobody who's who think that there's a pretension in jump scares. They're a bit stupid.
Yeah.
But he's like, wait, hold my beer. I'm going to show you that within a bit more serious film, I can just do that. And it makes complete sense because it's gothic horror. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting. So every time that somebody said to me like, oh, have you already seen Nosferatu? I was like, yeah. Is it good? I was like, it's not even really the question, is it good? It is good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find it amazing, it's because this is just really your cup of English Victorian tea with a side platter of plague and rats.
Another thing that I really like that this one did is it kind of did the Spielberg thing of hiding the monster for a really long time. I love that scene where Nicholas Hoult, I always forget which one, it's Thomas Hutter in this one, Jonathan Harker in Dracula. Thomas Hutter character gets to the castle, and in every single other one, he just kind of opens the door and goes, hi, I'm Nosferatu, like, welcome, help yourself to a cappuccino, no one's in, you know, do you want some bread, oh, can I lick your finger? And here,
I lick your finger?
Those be the beats. And here, I really dug the fact that they keep him shrouded in darkness for, like, quite an extended amount of time, where you only see, like, the light hitting the side of, like, oh, he's a mustache, oh, he looks a little...
Spoiler.
Spoiler, he looks like Jim Carrey in Sonic.
he fucking does! Oh my god!
I couldn't stop thinking.
Holy
about.
Shit, yeah, he looks like Dr. Robotnik.
He sure does.
Wow.
He also looks like he gyms quite well. There's one shot where he looked very strong.
Well, he don't have an ass.
He doesn't have something else.
Don't be packing no cake in that bakery.
There's no party in the back with... with Count Orlok.
I mean, he's a strong man. Ooh, he's got a long dong. We all saw it. Trigger warning, he shows meat in this movie. But yeah,
True. The thing is that they show him like shrouded for the longest amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then isn't the moment that he cuts his finger, there's this boom close up of his eyes. And suddenly you're face. Next. And, of course...
And I'm also very grateful for this movie because it gave Tom a new annoying voice to do around me.
Yes, I would like to partake in the recording of the podcast.
I hate it here. Please come save me.
Can I just say that I did find it a snooze fest, contrary to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to hear Elliot's
opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
But very briefly. Like, really briefly.
Don't forget your place. You're only the producer, Elliot.
Because it's a story so well told, there's not really much space you can go with it. And because it's so... He filmed it very well, like you said, with all the light and stuff, that it felt almost too perfect, that it sort of... It was too polished for me that I just couldn't really get into it. And then I found a lot of the acting perhaps overly dramatic.
Mm. I will say that Aaron Taylor Johnson bless his little heart, but like that guy did not belong in that movie.
No.
I would have much rather seen that go to someone else.
And the thing about this film, if we're talking about the performances, that Nicholas Hoult, fine. Adamant.
I think he's one of the best at being a scared little pussy.
Yeah.
He does that in every single movie. He's scared, and I love it.
Lily Rose Depp, for me, I was like, okay, this is Exorcist Reagan behavior. Very nice. Fully into it, and also her role, but this is something that somebody else pointed out to me after I'd seen it, the way that her role is handled and her agency in this film is very different from all the other Nosferatus. There's this question of wait, is it her fault? Oh, wait, she also kind of, spoiler, solves the issue herself. Mm-hmm. Mm. It's her thing. The guys have nothing to do about this.
She's totally, like, way more fleshed out than in any other iteration.
Yeah, she's not like, oh no.
I just so happen to want to be partaken
in this lust thing. Anyway, but Taylor Johnson, you realize that his performance is too much the moment the one, the only, the myth, the legend, the man who can handle any fucking dialogue from any fucking period piece, Willem Schnapps Dafoe, enters this movie.
You want some snaps?
Yeah, you want some snaps? I was like, wow, how does this man handle this dialogue as though it's nothing? It's like, he's like made for the weirdest shit.
He truly is a weird little freak, and I love him so much. Like, we value Willem Dafoe so much on this podcast, and he shows up, and I'm like, here we go. Here we motherfucking go. And it doesn't disappoint. Just, like, he has some, like, what was this? Like, I've seen things that would make Isaac Newton crawl back into his mother's womb or some shit. And I'm like,
how do you fucking get that out of your mouth? And then nobody in the audience will go like, oh, wow, that's a bit much, isn't it?
He is the one that shows so much empathy towards Ellen. And he also plays that part really well, where he, like, sits by the bed and gives her the lilacs and the... It's so such an incredible performance, whereas I felt like Aaron Taylor Johnson and maybe even Emma Corrin didn't really impress me that much. They had just a little bit less to work with, I think.
Do you want to take us back to the start, to what is my favorite Nosferatu out of all of them?
Yeah. I mean, we're moving all the way back through history to the silent era, where Murnau made the Nosferatu in 2022, which is not so loosely based on the Dracula book.
Well, they wanted you to believe that it was loosely based.
Very loosely. It's insane because, like, in the Dracula book, we have the synopsis for that is Jonathan Harker travels to Transylvania to assist Dracula with a property purchase in England, and Nosferatu is Thomas Hutter visits Count Orlok in Transylvania to help him with a purchase in Germany. So they really did like a Mad Lib and just like crossed out a couple names.
Yeah, we're not really sampling.
No, it's not the same. He goes to Germany. It's not England. Yeah. It's totally different. Have you recently rewatched that one?
I have not recently rewatched it. I watched this 1 million years ago. Mm-hmm. When I didn't look exactly like the actor Max Schreck, which I look like now.
There's a visual for you.
Yeah. I remember when I saw it the first time, you always think like, oh, it's a silent movie. It's from the silent era. It's super old. Shit, I gotta read. I still gotta read for these films. Intertitles, why?
I can't second screen
this. But then you realize, and I had this funnily enough with the Witches program as well. I saw the first time I saw Hoxham, which is also a movie from the 20s, and shit just blows you away. It's funny that movies, and now I sound like I've discovered silent films for the first time, but you always have the idea, oh, it's gonna suck, it's gonna be so boring, and then most of those films just work like clockwork.
Well, the reason those are the films we still talk about is because those ones are good. There's a whole bunch of silent films that sucked.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I might just add, so this comes from the German Expressionist era, and it's sort of a period that I'm familiar with because I wrote about it. But so it's similar to Dr. Cabinet of Caligari.
Which is also amazing movie still.
And so this is where you sort of get the beginning of sort of these very expressionistic shadows and playing with light and darkness, which is very impressive because, again, it's a lot of set design, and how they use that to make you really believe what you're watching is incredible, again, without words. But what for me it captured is the mood of German society at the time and like this foreshadowing of something to come. There's a writer called Siegfried Kuckauer who sort of drew this incredible line between these films and sort of the rise of Nazism in the 30s. And as you said before, sort of Nosferatu also encapsulates this idea of sort of the fear of the other and sort of all that stuff.
Xenophobia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you really feel that. And I think that's why it hits hard.
That is super insightful. And I also think it holds up really well. The things that are a little bit funny about it is that Thomas Hutter in this It's just the style of acting. You can really see how much acting has changed because he's just kind of going boom-pee-doom-pee-doom-pee-doom through life. And like he gets to this like village in like Romania or Bulgaria or whatever. And they're all like, don't go there. There's a vampire there. And they gave him these leaflets and stuff. And he's just like. And he doesn't show any like form, like expression of fear until Orlok like licks his finger with the blood. He's like, oh, wait, what the fuck is going on here? But up until that moment, he's just kind of like, I'm just going to make a little business deal.
It's a good question. Has that character really, really changed? I mean, all the other characters pretty much changed, but this guy.
Yeah.
This guy.
He's a doof.
This guy. I mean, he's a fucking doofus.
Been a doof, he's going to stay a doof. I mean,
Bruno Ganz, Keanu Reeves, all of them are just like, dude, get the fuck out of that. Don't even fucking go near that house.
Don't take the bread.
Yeah. Fuck.
My review was rip Count Orlok, he would have hated DocuSign.
Because you mentioned the German expressionism and the whole shadow play. And I mean, there are so many frames from this film which have become these super iconic shots, like especially the one of him like walking up the stairs, this bald figure with large long nails and doing almost a sort of... I'm doing it right now, but this is a podcast. With his claws, it's like this, like Michael Jackson in fucking Thriller sort of move. That really has become such a... They've become touchstones without you even thinking about that movie. And then there, of course, there's the whole Max Schreck thing, the actor that plays Nosferatu or plays Count Orlok that we know nothing about, but his name is Max Schreck, and Schreck is a German word for monster. Was he really a vampire in real life? It's like, what the fuck is this Blair Witch Project bullshit that we're putting on a movie from 1922? Like, maybe it was all real. Is it a documentary? Oh my god!
Let's get Willem Dafoe to play him.
Exactly.
Shadow of the Vampire.
Shadow of Vampire. By the way, Shadow of the Vampire, shout out, would have screened here if the filmmaker who made that isn't one of the most craziest guys ever, and that movie is completely, I think, lost for cinema because it's incredibly hard to book.
Who is the director?
The guy who made... he made one of those films that, especially during the early 2000s on the internet, was also this film that they thought like, oh my god, was this real? What kind of creepy bullshit is that? And Laura's now looking it up, and that movie is called...
Oh no, I was looking up the director's name, E. Elias Mering.
Yeah, Mering. Yeah. And Mering made a film called... Oh yeah, he made Begotten, which was this sort of, almost a sort of very pretentious art house Faces of Death kind of bizarre thing.
So then we have Dracula in 1931, which is so different from the movie that came out 9 years earlier.
I am Dracula.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading. You wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
It's a talkie, which was fun, with Bela Lugosi in the iconic role of Dracula, the way that we think of Dracula still, like Party City costume Dracula.
Yeah, the man with the cape.
Like the Count von Count,
yeah.
Dracula. That's the one that we still very much think about. That one was very, very different. It's truly insane to see them side by side and be like, oh, that was only 9 years later, but it's already so much more like the movies that we have now. It's quite slow, but it's very cool. I love how they did that.
Yeah, and it's very much a studio movie. You can see that his castle, which is clearly a set, but you're like, wow, is that a set? It's like huge. Huge. And it's, and of course, it's part of the entire Universal Monster
era.
Creature from the, I always want to say Black Lagoon. Or is it Blue Lagoon? Yeah, Black Lagoon. Frankenstein and, oh my God, the Mummy.
Yeah.
So it's part of that. And Lugosi is amazing, but it does change. He becomes this sort of, well, maybe here more than with the silent era, he becomes this very stately, eyebrow-raised aristocrat, yeah.
Less than like a savage, rat-like beast.
Right, right, yeah.
Another iteration of Dracula, which we all very much love, and kind of looks like Lugosi's one, is Christopher Lee in the Hammer Horror series, beginning with The Horror of Dracula in 1958. So this is kind of moving into the mid-century vampires. This is also part of the program.
Yeah.
Why did these make it into the program?
Yeah, because I thought, like, if you're showing that evolution of the character and the evolution of him becoming more of a count, and the Hammer Horror Dracula ones with Lee and Peter Cushing as Van Helsing change the... also very much change the way of how that character is handled. It's like this thing where I wanted to show that character in all the different iterations, and Christopher Lee does something very different with it. And the Hammer Horrors are a bit more goofy in a way.
What is Hammer Horror?
It's like the studio, basically, that made a whole bunch of horror movies. If you think we have sequel fatigue now, there's 7 Dracula movies starring Christopher Lee, and they get really pretty crazy. There's even like a Kung Fu vampire crossover called The Legend of the 7 Golden Vampires, which doesn't star Christopher Lee, but is all part of this huge like series of all kinds of like horror movies that came out from like the late 50s to like the 70s, like late 70s somewhere. And yeah, they were very different, and they also highlighted a lot more like the lust and the sexuality. Yeah. They're pretty goofy. Then that kind of brings us to the 70s, where we have as part of the program Andy Warhol's Blood for Dracula and Werner Herzog's Nosferatu, which are both like mid to late 70s.
And both feature actors which are completely mad. So Blood for Dracula, produced by Warhol, directed by Paul Morrissey, features Udo Kier.
It must be tonight. The girls are beautiful. They look so pure. But how can we get at them?
We'll wait until everyone is asleep. And then we try to find the bedrooms. But it's difficult, because the villa is so large. And it's a risk, because if someone sees us, it looks suspicious.
I mean, the most culty of cult horror actors ever, funnily enough, also starring in Blade and dying in a sunset. I think that's clear casting, because it was like, oh yeah, Udo Kier, wasn't he a vampire before? But yeah, Blood for Dracula is a strange film. It's you've never seen so many people throw up blood because he can't handle... I've seen this such a long time ago, but I believe he can't handle blood, so then he just starts throwing up. So he sucks the blood out of something, and it's a bizarre film.
It's like with me and coffee, where I'm like, I love coffee, but it hurts my tummy.
Exactly like you and coffee. It looks like you projectile vomiting coffee is exactly the same thing. Yes, Laura?
Yes.
And then, of course, we have Klaus Kinski in Nosferatu Phantom der Nacht by Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog, the movie about the abyss.
Please, let me do it. It's the oldest remedy in the world.
Oh, forget it. It's hardly worth mentioning. Just a little cut.
Absolutely.
Which is partly filmed in Delft, here in Holland, featuring next to Klaus Kinski, 11,000 rats. Yay!
Factoid,
yeah, yeah. The Dutch novelist and biologist Maarten de Hart apparently was asked to help out Werner Herzog to handle the rats, and then coming on set he realized that the hats
rats with hats they all had hats.
Well, maybe Maarten de Hart would have stayed if the rats would be wearing hats, but this is starting to become like a fucking Dr. Seuss podcast. But the rats were handled in such a terrible way that that he was like, fuck this shit. Yes. I am not going to be on this movie. But the most important thing to touch on with something Nosferatu by Herzog is that it's very interesting to see how Isabella Adjani plays the role of Ellen in that version.
So this is something that the one thing that really stood out to me is that he like jumbles up all the names from Dracula and Nosferatu in this Nosferatu one, because she's named Lucy in this one, which in Dracula is like the friend of Mina, who is Ellen in Nosferatu. So he like really like jumbled up all the names, but kept all the names from the books, but just like gave them to all different people.
Yeah, so it's partly very much more Dracula, but then partly also very much more Nosferatu, which is strange because that was the sampling of...
Exactly, but I interjected, but her name in this is Lucy. And the interesting thing about her playing that is ..
Oh, .. That Isabella Adjani, who I love as a screen presence, plays her very differently than the ways that she's been portrayed before. But the performance of Lily Rose Depp in Eggers' Nosferatu seems to be very much more based on Isabella Adjani's performance in Possession, which is another film that she was in. So it's like this, there's this weird
little sidestep.
Sidestepping through cinema to come back to Eggers' work, I guess.
So that was in 1979, and that moves us into the 80s and the 90s. And vampires here really start to make a change from like a count hiding in a castle to just regular dudes who walk among us in regular rural towns who are way more complex and humanized. So we have quite a few movies in our program from this era, most essentially The Lost Boys, The Hunger, and Interview with a Vampire. I think The Lost Boys is a big one.
Michael and Sam have just moved to Santa Carla, California. They're about to discover its secret.
Notice anything unusual about Santa Carla yet?
No. It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire.
That came out in 1987, and it really portrayed like a youthful, edgy, leather jacket, mullet-wearing, druggy-looking vampire. Kiefer Sutherland, majestic mullet, by the way. And also the whole blood thing becomes a lot more essential. It gets pushed a lot more to the forefront. It gets handled a little bit like a disease, like a vampire could infect you with their vampire-ness. And what was kind of happened in the 80s around a fear of blood? Of course, the AIDS epidemic. But also what I think The Lost Boys does in a really cool way is it really projects it to teenagers. And it really like the outcast, like being an outcast and nobody understands you, mom, like slamming doors. But also very much the dangers of lust and like free sex and just kind of like ignoring your parents' good advice and going to bang a hot girl because she's cool and turns out to be a vampire and ruins your life. So
yeah, they're all like very much doomed, which feels probably, well, I mean, as a teenager, that's how you feel. So that's, I guess, why those films resonate.
Yeah, I also think it's very cool because they're like very free and they're riding their motorcycles, but they're also like very lonely. And that's really shows like the dichotomy of them like struggling with, oh, this is really super cool. Like, I love being a teenager / vampire, but also like, oh, nobody understands me and it gets really lonely. Yeah. And
but that's the Spike thing that you mentioned. Like the why Spike in Buffy the Vampire Slayer is such an interesting character is that for the entirety of the series, it's completely in the middle if he really is a bad guy. Mm-hmm. At some point he is, but then you really care for him, but then he's a dick again. It's like this, you're... And I think as a teenager, you feel the exact same way.
Yeah.
You're at odds with things, but you're also misunderstood. And like it's like this finding your place. Like it's the outsider. Yeah.
And you love wearing leather jackets.
Absolutely. That's a big, having highlights in your hair. Yeah.
So a thing that actually is a precedent to Spike actually references this in Buffy where he goes, oh, are people still falling for that whole Anne Rice act? So that brings us to Interview with a Vampire, which came out in 1994, stars Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, and a very young Kirsten Dunst. She's like, I think like 10 or 11. She's super good in this.
I'm flesh and blood, but not human. I haven't been human for 200 years.
From the novel by Anne Rice. From Neil Jordan, the director of The Crying Game.
I've come to answer your prayers. Life has no meaning anymore, does it?
His name is Lestat.
But what if I could give it back to you? Pluck out the pain and give you another life. One you could never imagine.
I can see you lying on a bed of satin.
He chose one man. He gave him infinite power. Eternal life. And a daughter who would be forever young.
And this is basically two vampire dads raising a little girl.
And Antonio Banderas.
And also Antonio Banderas. Yes. Very much Antonio Banderas also, but I think the core, the little nuclear family in this is two gay dads and a lesbian daughter.
Yeah, it's a fascinating film. There's so much. It's not even only homoeroticism. It's like pan. It's everything. It's like, and there again, you have the thing that vampires are these sexual animals, or well, not animals.
Well,
they're like
what makes these ones really interesting is that for the first time, we really show them struggling with the fact that they like have to do this to stay alive. Yeah. So it's almost like vampire vegetarianism, where Brad Pitt like starts eating rats and like small animals because it's like, I don't want to kill people. I don't like killing people. Yeah. And then they find this girl and there's like the plague and they're like, oh no, she's going to die if we don't turn her right now. And he really struggles with the guilt of like infecting her. Mm-hmm. And he really struggles with the guilt of like having to kill people. Sometimes I thought that was so camp. It's looking camp right in the eye, but it's really beautiful.
Yeah, and it has been very much. I mean, we're screening in the new 4K restoration, which came out last year. It's been reevaluated in that it's featuring way more stuff than I remember from when I saw it in the 90s, where it's this campy costume vampire drama. But it's a pretty damn great film.
Yeah, if you're into camp.
If you're into camp, yeah. And if you can handle Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise blowing it up.
Then in the late 90s and early 2000s, we get to what we were just talking about, Buffy, and the whole like insane goth revival, because this is when I was a teenager and I didn't realize that this was like a fashion trend thing. I just thought it was like my soul speaking. It's like, I'm goth and like nobody understands this. And it's like, oh no, it's like literally in every store and you can buy a pentagram at H&M. But it really saw a goth revival with witches as well as vampires becoming like super mainstream with movies like The Craft, Queen of the Damned, From Dusk Till Dawn, and also Blade.
Charmed.
And with TV shows like Charmed and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And yeah, we have to mention Buffy the Vampire Slayer because that was a huge one for both Tom and I.
I would have featured the film if anybody would have known the film. I mean, I think everybody knows the series, but the film with Christy Swanson.
And
Rutger Hauer in a great performance and the best steak death in a movie ever, where, what is it? Pee Wee Herman plays a vampire that dies. Paul Rubens, thank you. And then constantly goes like, and just takes ages. It isn't a great film, but it's interesting because it relates to something that we both really love.
Yeah, and Joss Whedon actually wrote the screenplay for that, and then it became a TV series, which is how we all remember Buffy as the iconic Sarah Michelle Gellar. Struggling with all kinds of things, from boyfriends, high school, annoying moms, periods and friendships, but also brooding sexy vampires and all kinds of demons that crawl out of the hellmouth that is Sunnydale.
And just to clarify, because I'm a bit younger, and so I don't actually, I've never watched Buffy.
A weird flex.
That's okay, baby. What we can tell you all about it.
But was it like a big cultural moment thing, or was it just for
I really think it was a huge cultural moment thing. I don't think everyone was as into it, but I do remember being able to buy like posters in stores.
So it was
like a huge mainstream thing. Also, TV used to be so different where, so I'll tell you about linear television. There was this thing.
If you binged something, you had to wait a week.
It was like a huge cultural thing because it's the only thing you could watch on Tuesday night on Netflix or whatever. So that was a really big, and it ran for a really long time. And it was kind of cool. I was younger than Buffy was, but it was kind of like this thing that I aspired to be like. They were all like quippy and fast talking. And I don't know, maybe I kind of ended up that way a little bit. So yeah, that was a huge one for vampires. And that really like did even more for normalizing the vampire as just like the ones that walk among us and hang out with high schoolers. And then speaking of hang out with high schoolers.
Oh, here we go. Here it is.
Let's move it along to your personal favorite, Tom. We have Twilight, where a 180-year-old vampire called Edward Cullen, for some unfathomable reason, goes to high school and falls in love with a sulky teenager.
You're impossibly fast and strong.
You gotta give me some answers.
I'd rather hear your theories.
I have considered radioactive spiders and kryptonite.
It's all superhero stuff, right? What if I'm not the hero? What if I'm the bad guy?
You know what you are? Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Is that what you would do if you were a 180-year-old kind of hot vampire? Would you just be like, oh, maths, let's...
Yeah, but also in that town. I can't remember where it is.
Forks.
Forks, yeah. Why in Forks of all fucking places?
For Forks' sake, I guess.
Yeah, for Forks' sake, yeah. Yeah, what a fascinating film that was. I mean, when I started working here, I said to somebody, which was 8 years ago, I said to somebody, I'm going to screen Twilight someday, and it's going to sell out because it has become a cult classic. And I remember that colleague saying, you are completely high on your in your mind. That movie sucked. Whatever you really think about Twilight when you first saw it, if you saw it when it came out, and... If now think back to it and your opinion is, well, that was a terrible film. I realize that some movies are just, they change through either nostalgia or when people saw them and they were younger and then years later they've become this touchstone. And especially for 12 to 14 year old girls that saw Twilight when they were young and then they, it has, there's this... The real sort of, for me, quality of the movie is not...
It's not even important.
Important at all.
Is this more your age range, Elliot?
Yeah, but I didn't watch it when it first came out.
But it wasn't made for you either.
No, it wasn't.
That's what I...
Sadly. a good flex we can say is that it sold out at a Celebrating Cinema film club that we did.
Mm.
Which was the first one, I think,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that was my first time watching it. And it was amazing. Like, yeah. I loved it so much just because it, you know, like you said, it's sort of this weird sort of moment in time that captures how teenagers were feeling, but you relate to it so much. And again, it's so ridiculous in so many ways, but yet the audience seemed to know every line and would be shouting.
Yeah. Yeah, it was almost like a screening of The Room, but people were like so into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's the thing. Like, yeah, it represents all these like teenage feelings, but also it's fucking ridiculous. Like, there's so many, what is the car brand? It's like a Volvo. It's like the whole thing is like a car ad.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You can see so many logos. Like, why are you driving a fucking Volvo?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the weird color palette that Catherine Hartwick uses, which is this, everything is like orange and
it was all like blue.
Yeah. No, the thing is that what she also does in 13, the movie that she made before that, is that when the characters change and things become more dark, the movie itself becomes darker. But what she does is that she makes everything just blue and green.
Yeah.
And I mean, listen back to the interview that we did for.
Yeah, Catherine Hartwick.
With Cardwick. What? Cardboard
Marker?
Cardboard Marker.
I love Catherine Hartwick.
But Kiriko also did a really great introduction where Edward Cullen basically shaped the relationships that she then went on to have.
For good and for worse.
So does she love it when a guy just like shows up in the corner of her room when she's sleeping?
Yeah, and glows. Like sparkles. Yeah.
But she had pictures of her previous boyfriends, and they had a remarkable, uncanny resemblance to her.
Especially in their hairdo. Yeah. Yeah, it is the most, it's one of them, it's a toxic relationship that people look up to. That's I
aspire to her.
Very interesting.
That's how I felt, because I didn't watch it until like the dead center of lockdown when we were all losing our minds. Like, what can I do to make myself more delirious? Let's watch all Twilight movies in 2 days. I sent my friend a Google Cal invite with like the schedules. Like, we're going to be watching these movies. And we did like themed snacks and everything. That was the first time for me watching it and being like, what, like 30 at that point, being like, oh my, this is not, oh no, why, girl, get out of there, like, lose this man. And it's just like, I still remember, you know, being 18 and wanting to date like a 30-year-old musician or something, and my parents be like, don't. So it's very much
The thing is, the scene where she goes to his house and then he talks about that he's listening to music, he's listening to Debussy because what is this, the pretension there of her going like, oh, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's what every teenage girl has done.
I've pretended to like things
a thousand times over. And I will still do it. You know, I will still do it if I find the right gentleman caller. But yeah, so Twilight.
My cell phone number is 06.
Get in touch with Lab 101. So after that, the vampires really, like, they could be anything. They could be a lonely, misunderstood kid and let the right one in, or mm-hmm. like a super annoying roommate and What We Do in the Shadows, or you mentioned Only Love Is Left Alive earlier, just like bohemian, druggy lovers. Elliot, you also mentioned A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which I'm still yet to see, which is also part of our program.
Oh, it's great. It's sort of this Iranian Western, and which it like fuses together what we know about vampires, but set in America. Yeah, in America. And you were explaining before sort of the history of how the vampire sometimes can be seen as anti-Semitic or a representation of our anti-Semitic, well, not ours, but people's anti-Semitic behaviors. And the Iranian director sort of takes this and expands on it and sort of uses it to show how we can also be Islamophobic. And so the character in this sort of embodies that, and they take the chador, which is sort of the long dress in Arabic culture of women, and sort of, and that is what you see as sort of the cape. And it's really cool to watch. I think it captures the fear that someone can have having to be alone at night, and sort of the vampire isn't the monster, it's everybody else around it. Mm. And you're sort of having to fear for them, which I think was a cool spin on it, if I remember it correctly.
And it's interesting to point out that it's one of the few films generally, but also in our program, I mean, Twilight is directed by a woman, but Anna Lily Amanpour, I should say, directed this. So it's a bit of the female gaze on the way of watching vampires, I would say. And it's beautifully shot in black and white.
It's really cool. Yeah. I see if I can catch that after we finish recording. So yeah, that brings us to the current times. I did want to still touch on what our personal favorites are. For me personally, one that we haven't mentioned because it's kind of a weird one, is Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Here occurred the frightening and shocking history of Prince Dracula and the woman he loved.
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yeah. Dracula.
There's a sinister, darker side to him. I find irresistible. I have never met any man with such a passion for life. He is unlike any man.
Which I rewatched here recently on the big screen. It's incredible. Gary Oldman goes absolutely ham as Dracula. It is so insane. Once again, it looks camp right in the eye. And if you're not sure if you're going to be into this, just watch the first scene where he goes full Vlad the Impaler. And it goes so hard.
Yeah, because that's the interesting thing about this one is that he turns it almost into a revenge story, really. Yeah. Because, well, you saw it more recently than I have.
He goes off to war, and then he just takes a while, you know? And then by that time, his wife, Mina, is really sad, and she throws herself into the river, and then he comes back. It's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet thing. It's like, I thought you died. Oh, my God, I thought you died. Fuck. Like, so then he's like
dead.
Super pissed. There's this balls to the wall scene when he comes back from war and finds out that she's dead. And he denounces God and the entire church explodes in blood. Perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. And then he just like starts impaling people, which apparently he didn't start doing until he was in his mid-30s. So if you're not where you're at in your career right now, you know, Vlad the Impaler, you know?
Yeah, there's still time.
There's so much that could still happen for you, and I believe in you. But yeah, everything in this movie is so like succulent, the lighting and the costume design and that is amazing, but I wouldn't be me and this wouldn't be this podcast if we wouldn't quickly touch on Nicolas Cage, because one that is also part of this program is Vampire's Kiss, which is absolutely insane.
I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire!
Well, why is it part of the program? Why has it ever been part of any program here, Laura?
Do you want to share the lore?
Well, you share the lore. You're responsible for even putting this movie on the map, quite literally.
I know. For the past 8 years, so Lab 111, the best rep cinema in Amsterdam, has been around for 8 years. And for 8 years, there's been a suggestion board. And there's been a mystery not to be named person who for 8 years has been writing Good Vampire's Lord. Kiss onto the suggestions board.
every fucking single month.
Every single month. And it started coming. I was like, which fucker keeps writing Vampire's Kiss? And I had to come out and say, it's me. We screened it last year, I think, as part of the
Lab suggestions. Thing, yeah.
Finally, they listen.
Really? I thought it was part of the Nicolas Cage.
Oh, maybe it was. See how many amazing things we do at Lab 111? It was part of the Nicolas Cage program. But yeah, that wasn't the only time that Nicolas Cage played a vampire. He also played one in 2023's Renfield, which is kind of mid because Awkwafina's in it and she's my kryptonite. I cannot do that. but he does a great job at playing like full-on Dracula in Renfield. So if you're like hungover, that's quite a fun one. Also featuring Nicholas Holt as a big old scared pussy once more. So Tom,
how on brand?
What is your favorite?
I was gonna say Bram Stoker's Dracula, but
and that's why we're buds.
And that's why we're friends. And the only thing that I will say about that then more is you haven't touched on Keanu Reeves' horrendous accent in that film.
It's my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, it's like he's gone. No, I don't know how to speak
it. It's like we were talking about this the other day, and I said it felt like he's wearing one of those like buzzy dog collars, where there's like someone next to the camera who just goes, fuck, English accent. He just goes full like Keanu Reeves and like. You could see anything, even my mind. but then the next sentence, he just drops like the most over-the-top British word. It's like someone's like poking him under the table.
Yeah, it's one of those films where you can read the cast and go like, oh my God, Gary Oldman. Oh my God, Winona Ryder. This is a great movie because, despite Keanu Reeves. It's Coppola. We have a Megalopolis episode about his megalomania, and this movie again. Sometimes you wonder how much cocaine was there on the table for this guy to snort, because his movies are just completely out of their mind.
But it works he has good source material. Yeah. He has a good story to work off of. So then the crazy shit works.
The only thing that I want to point out is that you mentioned Gary Oldman's performance, and this movie wouldn't be as fantastic without him. But reading up on it, I was amazed that he was, for the entirety of the shooting, in character. What the hell? If you see 5 minutes of him in this film and then just think, good Lord, this is this guy in his
trailer. Imagine running into that guy at the craft table.
Like, fuck. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
are there any more pierogies left? Well, I think that's a beautiful place to leave this right now for today. You can find links for tickets to our Lust for Blood program in the show notes. Next week, we have a conversation with legendary filmmaker Raoul Peck to celebrate his new film, Ernest Cole, Lost and Found, which is a documentary about the forgotten but incredible first photographer of apartheid in South Africa. This also coincides with the Raoul Peck Collection, a retrospective program that we're also running here at Lab 111. Check out our last interview with the directors of No Other Land, but also check out our conversation with Catherine Hardwick, the director of Twilight. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us be found by fellow film fans. And don't forget to check out the show notes for all the films that we mentioned and bonus info and ticket links and everything you want. It's all in there. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.